I was trained as a reproductive tract developmental biologist back at Harvard Medical School. When I was recruited here, of course, I'm going to continue to study reproductive tract biology. And one of the more interesting aspects of reproductive tract biology is the fibroids. It's the most common tumor in women by far, and no one really knows how they start, and no one really knows how they grow. And so I thought that that would be a really good way for me to advance our knowledge and continue these studies.
When fibroid tumors are not treated, the result is what? What is the procedure that most women experience?
So almost all women will have fibroids. They can become problematic, and then women will go to see their doctor and say, I'm having these issues, and the doctor will say, it's because you have fibroids. The only cure at this moment is a hysterectomy, which is removal of the uterus, which for some younger women, that could be very traumatic because they're giving up their fertility. For older women, a lot of times it's not that big an issue, but they still feel that having a uterus is part of being a woman, and there's a lot of psychological issues associated with that.
How many hysterectomies are performed every year in the United States?
600,000. Half of those are because of fibroids.
So as you take a look at this, what did you discover?
There are no good medical treatments. Some hormonal treatments might be okay for a little while, but you don't want to put women on hormonal treatments because of other issues associated with excess hormonal treatment. What we've found in this study is that the fibroids, which are growing, these are sort of highly collagenous. It looks like cartilage growing inside muscle. The other tissue that's very close by to the uterus, that's a lot of cartilage, is the cervix. When we discovered that these genes that are associated with the cervical cells were found in the fibroids, we immediately thought that perhaps the fibroids are turning into fibroids because they want to be more like cervical cells, which is not what they should be.
How does that happen?
We don't really know how it happens. We have some ideas. There are two major types of fibroids based on genetic alterations. We don't know what those genetic alterations actually do to make the cell behave like a fibroid, but we know it at the end. These genes that are associated with being more like a cervix are upregulated. In other words, genes get turned on when they shouldn't be.
The research was collaborative. Explain how all this work came together and to come to the results that you have so far.
This kind of study really takes a team. We have the benchtop scientists, which is my group. Then we have Wei Shen, who's up the street at Van Andel Institute, which I believe is the center of the epigenetic universe right now. So we're very lucky just to have those people a few blocks away. And then we have our collaborators at Spectrum Health who collect these tissues and consent these patients and allow us to get those tissues that we need to make these studies happen. None of it could have been done without that kind of collaboration. We need the clinical specimens, we need the person doing the bioinformatics, and then we need the benchtop science.
Take me through everybody's role in this and how it came together.
The idea was one that I've been wanting to study for quite some time, and often with these kinds of things, you have great ideas, and everybody can have great ideas, but if you don't have the tools to actually implement those ideas, then it's sort of just an idea, and it stays that way. But when Wei Shen and the epigenetics people moved into the Van Andel Institute a few years back, I was finally in a place where, hey, we can do this big data type of study now and look at what might be going on. Not at the genetic level, because we kind of know what's going on with those genes that get mutated, but at the epigenetic level, what else is going on in those genes that isn't necessarily a mutation? And then, of course, we have to have a clinical partner. And we've been very lucky to have Dave Chesla over at Spectrum Health doing the clinical work for us, which means, you know, having his team do all that consenting, collecting the tissues, anonymizing it, meaning that we don't actually get any patient information. Then our team takes the tissue and does the basic cell isolation techniques, DNA isolation, RNA isolation, and we do the study with the big data, and then with the help of the epigenetics people, they do the analysis.
And now that you have some results here and the funding from the National Institute for Health, what is next? Where do you take this study?
We have funding to continue. This was kind of a pilot study. We only had a few patients in each group because these kinds of experiments are very, very, very expensive. Now we have enough to do 100 patients and to look at their DNA and RNA. What's nice about having 100 patients is now we can look at those two major genetic alterations and look at them separately. We'll have enough samples to look at those separately. And we'll also be able to collect enough samples from African-American women and Caucasian women and Asian women because the incidence in African-American women for fibroids is much higher. The reasons for that racial disparity are completely unknown. So we're hoping that since we, meaning the field, has been unable to determine any really significant genetic differences between the African-American women with fibroids and Caucasian women with fibroids, that it must be epigenetic. So that's what we're going to continue with the study.
It's a fascinating study. Looking forward to the findings from phase two. Jose Teixeira, your professor in the Department of Obstetrics, Gynecology, and Reproductive Biology at Michigan State University College of Human Medicine. Thank you so much.
Thank you.